So we have another two-parter today, continuation of the Drosophila saga. This is the easiest day for that in terms of what you have to do. What is the only thing you have to do? Not the parents. Yeah, the parents are already gone. You have to take out the F1s, which are all the adults at this point that remain in your tubes. And it's important for you to get every adult because you don't want any of them to mate with the adults to be, which are now not looking like flies, they're larval stage. Right? So you've already counted these things, you've already looked at them last week. There's no need to do that again, but make sure you get every adult out. Or at the very least, make sure that any adults remain are definitely dead. Okay, if you do have some dead and deeply embedded adults, don't bother disturbing the medium for the sake of getting them out, because if you know they're dead, they're definitely not going to mate. But if they're right at the surface and stuck, you know, you can use something to get them unstuck maybe. Just don't disturb the medium more than you absolutely have to. Most of them, though, should come out freely. Now, to get rid of them, you first have to nap them, so don't just open up the lid. You don't nap them for the sake of looking at them, like I said, though, so you can permanently nap these things. Just make sure you don't nap them in the vial with the medium, because then you'll kill the larvae and things will be ruined. So once again, use as many vials as you need to. Don't think that you need to have every fly into that one vial all at once. Do it in stages if you need to. But if you use the tapping method to coax them into the other vial, that needs to be gentle tapping, especially today, because you need to save the vial. And it's, you know, that food is where the larvae are right now. You don't want to disturb that. So don't dislodge that by tapping. Shouldn't take that much tapping. Just a gentle tapping will let them fall into the other tube. Do that multiple times if you need to. Permanently nap them, meaning just leave the brush in there with fly nap on it for several minutes. Once they're fully immobilized, dump them into the fly morgue. All right, that's all you need to do for that one. And then just when you're done, put your, not empty because it has the larvae in it, your still important tubes right back onto the same tray that you got them from. Not this tray that's closer to my station. This one is your tray. All right? That brings us to the other part, which is the new stuff, and that is, I think it's exercise 4 in the manual, has to do with exceptions to Mendelian genetics. So basically, various ways in which the assumptions of Mendelian genetics are violated. Anytime those assumptions aren't met, then you have exceptions to Mendelian genetics, and therefore things don't really appear as neatly as they do how you first learn Mendelian genetics. All right, so for the sake of what you're doing, really it's just going around and looking at various things. And I say get going around because you're going to, where you're sitting right now, which is where you usually stay for the day, will be a station. Each microscope will have something different to look at, and I'll put different sheets around explaining what you're looking at. So make sure you go around and look at every example, everything that has a different sheet on it. All right? Really, all you need to do is make sure you look at everything, make sure you understand why what you're looking at is an example of what is described on the paper, and write down your observations. Now, think about this two ways. You can, before I forget, the manual, I think, tells you to actually make counts of them. I don't want you to bother doing that. It's a waste of time. I want you to understand it. So just look at them, write down your observations, and that will satisfy the notebook points component of it. But also realize that, as always, your notebook can be used as an open notebook for the test. So anything that you want to write beyond that, that you think will be helpful if you need that information later, is up to you. But no statistics or anything, no numbers, just write your observations today. Before I let you loose on looking at them, though, which doesn't take all that long, I want to talk about some basic concepts that are related to this. First of all, we said that one of the assumptions for a gene to behave in a Mendelian fashion is for there to be complete dominance. So let's just talk about incomplete dominance, which obviously is an exception, right? Incomplete dominance is the situation in which a heterozygote doesn't fully have the phenotype that a homozygous dominant does. And you can think about this in terms of molecular biology. What is it that gives you or any organism its traits directly? No, that's indirect. Proteins, that's right. The proteins that those genes indirectly code for are what actually directly give you your traits. Okay, so it's what the actual version of the protein that you make is what gives you your traits. So think about how proteins are created. It's a two-step process, right? Transcription first, then translation. DNA is involved in the transcription. That produces, in the case of a protein-coding gene, which is what we're talking about, a messenger RNA, which is now carrying the code. DNA's job is done. And that messenger RNA then gets translated into a string of amino acids called a polypeptide. That's the protein that actually gives the individual its trait. All right? So think about a homozygous dominant individual. First of all, this is a diploid individual, right? And therefore has two alleles for that gene. In this case, the two identical alleles. The alleles on the two homologs or homologous chromosomes that carry that locus are identical. And therefore, there's two opportunities to create messenger RNA. Both of those two alleles can independently be transcribed. That means that individual has the capacity to make twice as much messenger RNA as a heterozygote would be. mRNA of that type, right? And therefore, twice as much messenger RNA can be translated in the same amount of time into twice as much protein, which is what actually gives you the trait. So the classic textbook example usually taught for incomplete dominance uses flower color, just like complete dominance, purple versus white is what you usually learn. But in incomplete dominance, using a different species, flower color still has two alleles, but there's three possibilities: fully red, white, or pink, right? Well, the reason that makes sense is that the redness comes from the red protein pigment that's made. A homozygous dominant individual has the capacity to make twice as much as one that only has one allele for the red. And therefore, that heterozygous individual becomes pink because it's really only making half as much redness, so it's halfway red. Okay? Sometimes, though, just having one copy is enough to fully give you the phenotype, which is what we have in the case of complete dominance. All right, well, I wanted to explain that first before we get to this next batch of definitions. Let's distinguish between expressivity and penetrance. Who wants to define either one of those? Expressivity first. What is expressivity? These two, expressivity and penetrance, are easy to confuse, but there's a fundamental difference. Expressivity is the degree to which a phenotype is expressed. That's right. And importantly, I want to add on to that, that this is assessed on an individual basis. So you're talking about one individual at a time. If you know its genotype, that really predicts what its phenotype should be, right? Well, sometimes the phenotype isn't fully expressed, even though the genotype is held by that individual. So how fully it is expressed is the expressivity for that individual. And therefore, if there is variable expressivity in a population, that means not all the individuals with the same genotype will have exactly the same degree of that corresponding phenotype. All right? Expressivity is assessed on an individual basis, though. Penetrance, on the other hand, is a measurement population-wide, not individually. Penetrance isn't really concerned with how fully the phenotype is expressed in individuals. Rather, it's what fraction of individuals in a population that share a genotype express the corresponding phenotype at all. So if they do, at least partially, then they're included in the tally. If they don't, they're not. Okay, so 100% penetrance, in other words, would be the situation in which if you look at only the individuals with the same genotype and you count how many express the phenotype at least partially, don't count the ones that don't express it at all, and then divide by that total number of individuals, you're going to get a fraction, right? That fraction is the penetrance for that particular trait. Does that make sense? Okay, so you're used to thinking about it when you first learn genetics. You're used to thinking about 100% penetrance. You know, if you have the genotype, you're going to have the phenotype. It's not always the case, though, for various reasons. One reason is that usually other genes actually partially determine a trait along with the gene you're interested in. And beyond the genetic component, remember that there's always an environmental component to whatever the phenotype is. It's not just genetics that matter. So that's the difference between expressivity and penetrance. And one exception to Mendelian genetics that you're going to observe today is incomplete penetrance, meaning that some of the individuals with a given genotype in that population will not show the corresponding phenotype. So it's something less than 100% penetrance. Okay. The other thing I wanted to talk about is the concept of dosage or gene dosage. And this brings up, once again, the distinction between the two fundamentally different categories of chromosomes that you have in sexual species. What are those two types of chromosomes? X and Y are the same type. They are sex chromosomes, as opposed to what?
Autosomes.
Yeah, those are the two categories. Sex chromosomes, which are so named because one of their jobs is to determine the sex of the individual, but they do more than that, right? And then all the others, which are autosomes. Beyond giving that as a distinction, there's a molecular distinction between the two. Autosomes come in truly homologous pairs, meaning that the two homologs, the two number ones, for instance, in the autosomes, are the same size, and they have the same number of loci. They have the same number of genes on them. Whereas two sex chromosomes in a diploid individual aren't necessarily the same size. X and Y, the two types of chromosomes that are used in us and also these flies, it's not always X and Y, but it is for these two species that we're talking about. They are not the same size, and therefore they are, even though they correspond to each other, they are not truly homologous. Right? So this is the basis for calling a gene X-linked or sex-linked versus calling it autosomal. If it's an autosomal gene, that simply means its locus is somewhere on any of the autosomes. If it's X-linked, it's on a sex chromosome. And in different species use different sex chromosomes. For instance, there are ZW species. But like I said, we and these flies are XY species. In those species, which is the bigger chromosome? The bigger sex chromosome. X is bigger. It has a greater number of loci, which means that there are some loci on the X chromosome that don't correspond to any locus on the Y chromosome, because that part on the Y doesn't exist. And so these X-linked chromosomes, as they're called, or more generally, sex-linked chromosomes, are chromosomes for which one of the sexes, in this case the male, who in the XY system is XY versus XX as the female, one of those sexes has only one allele for that gene, whereas the other sex has two, just like for an autosomal gene, right? For any autosomal gene, it doesn't matter what the sex is, there are going to be two alleles for that gene in a normal human, in a normal individual. One for each of the two homologous chromosomes. So here's where the phrase gene dosage comes into play. Dosage meaning how much the individual has. Well, in the case of XY species, the female has a double dose of alleles for a sex-linked gene compared to the male. He has only one allele, she has two. So she has a double dose. That's what gene dosage refers to. And it's possible for there to be a gene dosage effect for exactly the same reason I described in incomplete dominance. Since she has two alleles, she has the opportunity to produce twice as much messenger RNA of that type, which means she has the opportunity to produce twice as much protein compared to the male, and therefore she could have a double dose of the phenotype compared to a male, because it's the protein that gives you the phenotype. And so that is one exception to Mendelian genetics, whether if there is a dosage effect, gene dosage effect. If there is, it's not that the phenotypes are different between a male and a female, it's that the male has a stronger, more pronounced phenotype than the male does because of that double dosage. By the way, if we're talking about a male in the XY system and we're talking about a sex-linked gene, then the normal terminology that we apply to individuals does not apply. It doesn't make sense to call a male for a sex-linked gene in the XY system either homozygous or heterozygous. Right, because both of those words presume the existence of two alleles. Right, homozygous means they're both the same. Heterozygous means the two are different. Well, neither one of those makes sense if you only have one allele, which a male does for a sex-linked gene. So we don't use those. We use those words to apply to females, but for males we use what terminology? Hemizygous. Correct. Hemi meaning half, because he has only half the number of alleles that the female does. So there can be a gene dosage effect, but not necessarily, because there can also be what is called dosage compensation, meaning that the species somehow makes up for the fact that the female and the male are not on equal grounds with respect to their number of alleles. And this applies only to sex-linked genes. So if there is dosage compensation, then you won't see a gene dosage effect. Also remember that when it comes to hemizygous males, we lose the dominance and recessivity relationship, right? That doesn't make sense either, because he has only one allele. Whatever allele he has, that's what's going to determine his phenotype, at least genetically. We also use different symbology when we write his genotype. Hemizygous male has only one allele and therefore will have just one symbol. For instance, if we're talking about the C gene, whatever that is, if it's sex-linked, then a female can be either upper C, upper lower C, or lower C as normal. But a male is going to be either upper C, zero indicating that the other one doesn't exist, or lowercase z, zero. So that would be a hemizygous genotype. So if there is dosage compensation, then you do not see a gene dosage effect. There are two fundamentally different ways to accomplish dosage compensation, and it depends on the species. And even though we and these Drosophila both use XY system, we accomplish dosage compensation differently. The fundamentally different ways in which you can do this, though, makes sense if you think about it, is that you could bring the males up to the level of the females with respect to ability to make a given number of proteins in a given amount of time. The male has half the number of alleles to work with, so if you just transcribe that one allele that the male has twice as often, if you turn on his gene more than you turn on either of the two female alleles, then you're bringing the male up to the level of the female. As long as you make the same amount of messenger RNA with that one allele as the female makes with her two alleles, then phenotypically they should be the same, right? Because the same number of messenger RNAs will lead to the same number of proteins being produced. And that is actually how these flies do it. But that's on a gene-by-gene basis, which is why you can, for some genes, have a dosage effect, and for other genes, you have dosage compensation. Okay? The other fundamentally different way of accomplishing compensation is to bring the female down to the level of the male. And this is how we mammals do this. What is that process called in mammals that leads to this? Anyone know? You females should know. You've already done it before you became aware. It was when you were just a few cells big as an embryo. It's called X chromosome inactivation. So when you are just a few cells big as an early embryo, each of those cells, however many there were, had two X chromosomes, right, by definition. At that point, each cell basically flips a coin and randomly chooses one of the two X chromosomes and tightly coils it up so that it won't ever be used for the lifetime of that individual. So it's turned off permanently in your body. It can be turned back on when you make eggs for the next generation, but it's turned off for you. All right? And so that brings you down to the level of the male because you really only have one functional allele for those sex chromosomes. But notice that's chromosome-wide, so it's not on a gene-by-gene basis. This is also, by the way, why female mammals can be mosaics, as they're called, genetic mosaics, like a calico cat, for instance, which has patchiness with respect to coloration, no pattern really. That's because when you're just this several cells big and each cell turns one randomly off, if you happen to be heterozygous, meaning your two alleles are different, then one cell is going to have the dominant allele turned on, and another cell will have a recessive allele turned on. The dominant one got inactivated. And wherever that cell lies in the ball of the embryo, all of the cells that this one cell will eventually give rise to by splitting several times, in other words, that section of the body will have the phenotype corresponding to that allele, and next door, another slice of the body will have the other allele potentially. And that's what happens in calico cats, for instance. In humans, it's possible for a female to be a mosaic with respect to the ability to sweat, which you can't tell really like you can with a calico cat just by looking at her. But there will be sections of her skin that sweat, other sections that don't, because of if she happens to be heterozygous. All right, anyway, that's the information about sex linkage and gene dosage and dosage compensation. Another example that you're going to look at, and this one actually won't be out on your tables, it's up here already, and these aren't things that you want to look at under the scopes at all. This is just macroscopic observation. This is an example of a conditional allele. Right? Any given conditional allele is called that because the phenotype that's expressed depends on the condition. And what the condition is depends on whatever specific gene you're talking about. So the specific example of a conditional allele that we have for you to look at is an example of a temperature-sensitive allele, meaning that the condition that matters is the actual temperature. And the specific example of the temperature-sensitive allele we're looking at in these flies is called the Shibire allele, which roughly means numbness of limbs. So in the one that's labeled Shibire, if the temperature gets above a critical level, then these flies that were just normally walking around a minute ago will be temporarily paralyzed because the temperature causes a shape change in their proteins that no one critical protein for them to be able to walk doesn't work anymore. So it turns into a different conformation, but it's reversible. If you get it below that temperature again, they'll regain the ability to walk. And it's not very high temperature. It's low enough temperature that you can actually hold the vial in your hand and just for a minute or so, and that warmth from your hand will, it'll be like they're fly-napped, only it's just because of temperature. And if you let go and let it cool that back down, they'll be able to walk around again. Whereas the wild types, which are here by comparison, you can hold those all day, and they'll probably just speed up walking because you're heating them up. All right, so that one's up here to look at. Like I say, don't bother looking at them under the scope. Everything else you're going to look at under the scopes. I'm going to give you ones that I actually, that are dead from yesterday, because they're probably just fine to look at and see these things. But if you find that you can't actually see the traits that you're supposed to be seeing, like maybe their color has faded or something from being dead, then I'll nap some new ones. Let me know if it's not obvious. Okay, but while I'm bringing around these flies around to your stations, you should get busy on removing your adults, your F1s. Okay, let's do it.